Welcome to Two Way Street. We're going to start today's show with a conversation with historical novelist Stephen Harrigan. His new novel, A Friend of Mr. Lincoln, tells the story of the 16th president's year as a young lawyer in Springfield, Illinois. Based on extensive research, Harrigan paints a picture of Lincoln as having grand ambitions in his professional life, but at the same time being startlingly insecure and awkward when it came to his love life. Harrigan first came to public prominence when he published The Gates of the Alamo. The book won acclaim because he was able to create a suspenseful fictional narrative around an event about which most everyone already knew the outcome, the fall of the Alamo. Later, we'll talk to one of George's favorite sons, Roy Blunt Jr. He's written a new book, Save Room for Pie. But first, Stephen Harrigan. Stephen Harrigan, thanks for being here for Two Way Street.
I'm thrilled to be here, Bill. Thank you.
Abraham Lincoln has probably been written about more than any other president in American history.
Or any other subject, probably.
So, Stephen, what is it about your taking on these kinds of challenges?
I don't know. I mean, I've written novels about smaller things and smaller people, but I do like to sort of every once in a while take dead aim at something big. You know, I was daunted a little bit by the idea of writing about Lincoln, even in a historical fiction sense. And I knew there were like 10 million books about Lincoln already, and they're probably going to be 10,000 during the time I was writing the book. But I felt like I had a slightly different take, and I knew that I had a compelling character. There's a reason everybody's fascinated with Lincoln, and he is he's kind of an historical saint on one level, and everybody reveres him and admires him. Well, maybe not everybody. we're in Atlanta. There might be some residual, you know, feeling here.
Let's hope not, Steve.
But the other side of that sort of iconic image is a real human being. And when you're handed or when you seize a ready-made character like that who is so complicated and complex and self-contradicting in many ways, you just can't resist it as a writer. I mean, this is an interesting character to write about.
I know you've told other interviewers that one of the inspirations for this book was coming across a letter that Doris Kearns Goodwin quotes from in her Lincoln book, Team of Rivals.
Right.
What was that letter?
It was a letter that Lincoln wrote to Mary Owens, a young woman with whom he was sort of accidentally engaged. This was not Mary Todd. This was a previous woman named Mary. And Lincoln was young, and he was, you know, I think he was about maybe 30 at this point. And he had just moved to Springfield from the village of New Salem, which was 20 miles roughly northeast of Springfield. And he sort of had told this Mary Owens' sister that he would marry her if she came back to Illinois, but he'd only met her once. And he got cold feet about that. And my wife and I were driving cross country and listening to Doris Kearns Goodwin's book, Team of Rivals. And she quotes this letter in which Lincoln writes to Mary Owens and says, basically, I'm still willing to abide by the pledge I made to you, blah, blah. But in my opinion, you had better not do it. And I just love that. I love that sense of insecurity and confusion in this guy. And he wasn't the Lincoln I thought I knew. He was somebody who had stumbled into a situation from which he couldn't extract himself. And he was so confused and conflicted. And I just thought, I told my wife, Sue Ellen, let's make a detour to Springfield on this cross-country trip. And we did. And we were so knocked out by the palpability of that time. When you're in Springfield, you can still see all the same streets and a lot of the same buildings. And you can imagine being there with Lincoln. And the Lincoln I wanted to portray was somebody who was under construction as a human being. He wasn't quite there yet. He wasn't the person that we think we know. So it was that note of of uncertainty and bewilderment in that letter and cluelessness that made me realize, oh, this is a guy I could really write about.
You went to all the Lincoln sites in Springfield. Was there any one thing that just absolutely jumped out at you and really captivated you?
I think the thing that, and this is a little bit after the period of my book, but the thing that had the most startling effect on me was, you know, you can go to the Lincoln home, you know, where Abraham Lincoln and Mary lived after they were married, and where they raised their children. And you go through, there's a tour, and in the sitting room, there's a mantelpiece, a wooden mantelpiece, and there are holes in the wood. And that's where the Lincoln children hung their Christmas stockings. And, you know, you see something like that, and you're immediately just grabbed and sent back through time. And you can feel the reality of the past. And, you know, that's what I'm always looking for, are those kind of moments of historical epiphany where it's just so real to you and you feel like time has been erased somehow.
The Mary Owens story is really interesting because it really does show us how awkward, how unsure of himself Lincoln is, and how much he comes to rely on Cage Weatherby to help him sort through his emotions. I think I agreed to marry this woman, he says to Cage at one point.
Right.
But he's very awkward and very unsure. Mary Owens comes to visit, and Lincoln ignores her.
Yes, this is a well-known incident where they were out on a picnic, or I've invented it, a picnic. I'm not sure we exactly know what they were doing, but they were riding across a branch or a little creek. And Lincoln paid no attention to Mary Owens, who was riding behind him. And she, you know, it was customary for a gentleman to help a woman, across the creek as they're riding horseback. And she's deeply offended by this. He's up in front talking politics and telling dirty jokes. So she's deeply offended. And it's not that he's unaware of her. It's just that he doesn't know he's supposed to be aware of her. You know, it's like he doesn't, you know, this is a guy who came from nothing, from, you know, this little, they called half-face camp in Kentucky and Indiana. And he, log cabin, no schooling to speak of, except, you know, maybe a few months here and there. And certainly no lessons in etiquette. And here is, he's in this world in which a lot of these people in Springfield, including Mary Owens and later Mary Todd, are coming from fairly upper crusty families in Kentucky. And so they have expectations of how a man should behave. And he has really no understanding of what's expected of him. And so he's clueless. He's bewildered.
And Cage can't figure out why Lincoln is ignoring her the way he is.
Well, for one thing, he's not sure he's really supposed to marry her, I think. You know, it was, he just kept getting in, he kept having this problem of getting engaged to women he didn't really want to marry that bad. I mean, the historical record is a little murky on this, but the trend seems to be accurate that he just kind of accidentally got engaged.
Cage is also a very much part of the beginnings of Lincoln's relationship with Mary Todd.
Right.
Comes from a very prominent Lexington, Kentucky family. She's come to Springfield to find a husband.
Right.
And she seems to set her eye on Lincoln quite early on. Mm-hmm. You have an interesting way of describing Mary Todd. And I have to say, I've never thought of her in all of the Lincoln books I've read quite the way you describe her. You say this: Cage was keenly aware of Mary's sexual musk. He observes this silver necklace fastened to her throat. It was as if she had put it there only to signal that it should be removed, that everything she wore was only for the purpose of making you understand that there was bare skin beneath it. I find that fascinating because the last thing I ever think about Mary Todd and the way she's been described is as someone who is sexually alluring.
Well, but the contemporary accounts seem to indicate that
they
was. Yeah. And, you know, we have this image of Mary Todd Lincoln from those Civil War era photographs where she's not looking her best, But if you look at probably about 1847, Lincoln and Mary went to a daguerreotype studio in Springfield, and there are a couple images that, of them at that time. And Mary was, you know, I guess be late 20s, early 30s at this point. And I kept looking at this photo all the time I was writing that book and trying to sort of move her backwards in time to when she was younger, because she's a really intriguing looking woman. She's got a really frank, you know, gaze at the camera. She's very appealing looking. It's not hard to go from that image to think, man, she must have been sexy, you know? And so that, and clearly she had an effect on a lot of people in Springfield.
Well, okay, so you gave me a new image of Mary Todd. Their relationship was, and again, Lincoln looks to Cage to help him understand this effect that she is having on him, and it's not all good.
Right.
Right?
Yeah, I think he was genuinely attracted to her, both by her looks and by her background and by her...
She speaks French fluently. He's impressed with that.
Yeah, and, you know, she has the same sort of ambition that Lincoln does, you know, so they're made for each other in a way. And yet Lincoln is, again, he's so naive about women, and he doesn't know what he wants. He doesn't know what he should want in terms of a life partner. And during the course of the book, and which apparently happened in real life, he fell in love, or thought he fell in love, with this other woman named Matilda Edwards, who was sort of dazzling and, you know, floated into Springfield on a cloud, and everybody was just, you know, amazed at how wonderful she was. What happened with Lincoln was he had sort of gotten into this engagement with Mary. He tried to get out of it. She wouldn't really let him. And that caused a collapse on his part. And then later they got back together, and apparently they had some kind of riff. We don't know exactly what it is. I portray it in the book as best I can imagine it. And she seems to have released him from the pledge to marry her. And that's what really sent him. Even though that should have freed him, it humiliated him and made him think that he was not a man of honor, which was the most important thing in Lincoln's mind, his greatest aspiration. And so it just sent him into this deep spiral of depression and catatonia almost.
When we think about Mary Todd and Abraham Lincoln later in their lives, this spiraling depression that they were both capable of getting in, you know, when we think of them today, they're almost like a doomed couple.
Yeah, whether they were a doomed couple or they were a couple overtaken by doom is an interesting question. Had fortune smiled upon them a little more, had they not lost, you know, well, Lincoln wasn't around when Tad died, but had they not lost, you know, three children, had Mary not seen her husband shot to death in front of her eyes, you know, it might have, she might not have gone around the bend the way she did later in life. And, you know, it might have been a happier, at least more congenial marriage.
Yeah.
But I don't think they were, they each had expectations, I think, that neither could fulfill. Lincoln didn't know how to be a husband, frankly. I mean, he didn't know how to stay around. He was out on the judicial circuit, you know, twice a year for weeks and months at a time. And it was like being on a touring rock band or something. I mean, it was fun, you know, and just, it was a guy's guy kind of world. And Mary was left at home in this little one-room boarding house and, you know, with children. And it was, there were no servants or anything like that. So it was a come down for her. And I wouldn't say he was a neglectful husband by any stretch, but he wasn't aware so much. He hadn't grown up in a world where he understood what roles people were supposed to play.
We're going to take a short break, but when we return, we'll have more with Stephen Harrigan, author of A Friend of Mr. Lincoln.
Hurrah for the choice of the nation, our chieftain so brave and so true. We'll go for
for the great reformation, for Lincoln and liberty too. We'll go for the son of Kentucky, the hero of Hoosiers and through. Pride of the sucker so lucky, for Lincoln and liberty too.
Welcome back to Two-Way Street. If you're just joining us, my guest is historical novelist Stephen Harrigan. His new book is A Friend of Mr. Lincoln. It's a fictional but thoroughly researched account of Abraham Lincoln's early years in Springfield, Illinois. It tracks the beginnings of his political career and his clumsy efforts at romance. Virtually all of the characters that you write about in this book, except for one, are historical figures. They're people who Lincoln really did encounter, were friendly with, or were in his sphere.
Yeah.
The one exception is Cage Weatherby.
Right.
And Cage Weatherby is your creation, and it's through Cage's eyes that we really get to know the Abraham Lincoln you're trying to capture.
I very purposefully decided I was going to write a novel and not a history. And the job of a novelist is to get you in the room, get you as close to the action and the setting as possible. So I decided I would give myself permission, and I don't give myself a lot of permission when it comes to the historical record, but it felt like I needed to invent my own character through which to see Lincoln. And so Cage is a guy who meets Lincoln during the Black Hawk War in 1832. They have some adventures together that are fairly grisly, because Lincoln's job during the Black Hawk War was to sort of gather up the dead and mutilated bodies of the militia who had been killed by Indians. And so we follow Lincoln and Cage through, you know, the sort of beginning of both their careers. Cage's ambition is to be a poet. And Lincoln's ambition is outsized. It's ferocious.
Before we get to that part of the story, let's go back to their first meeting, because it really opens the book. What we first come across in your book is a fierce battle in which Cage Weatherby's regiment is under fierce attack by the Black Hawk Indians. They're driven back. Cage sees one of his, I don't know if he's a friend or simply another member of the regiment, killed virtually in front of his eyes.
Yeah.
He's a friend. Mm-hmm. Killed in front of his eyes.
There's a place called Kellogg's Grove, and this was the second battle of Kellogg's Grove that took place during that summer.
And then, as you say, Lincoln and they were called spies. Right?
They were in a mounted spy company.
Yeah.
Lincoln, during this part of the Black Hawk War, Lincoln had several iterations in which he was a captain at one point, and at this point he was a private in basically a ranger company.
Okay.
And, you know, they come riding to the rescue of these besieged men at Kellogg's Grove.
And right. I think your description of how Cage sees Lincoln in that first meeting is wonderful. Would you read that
for
us?
Sure. Yeah. Okay. This is when Lincoln is riding up with the rest of his men, and he introduces himself. He says, "I'm Abraham Lincoln." And remember, Cage has been shattered by what he's seen. I mean, he's got a little bit of PTSD, you know, after this horrific battle. So Lincoln says, "I'm Abraham Lincoln." He was young, or so Cage would remember him. He did not seem young at the time. No one did in that summer of 1832, during the hard and mostly meandering campaign of the Black Hawk War. Lincoln would have been his own age, 22 or 23. He had ridden all night. He was gaunt and unshaven and hard used, his feet caked in dry mud, the buttons gone from the placket of his shirt, and his narrow sunburned wrist protruding from its tattered sleeves. He was a head taller than the five men who were with him, too tall for the little mare he was riding, too tall for even his own clothes, since the frayed bottoms of his jean pants were a good 5 inches from the tops of his brogans.
It's a wonderful description. I like the next sentence, which is, he was not as freakishly remarkable in his appearance as it would later become fashionable to recall.
What Cage recognizes in Lincoln is somebody who has the empathy to recognize another person in distress and reach out to him. And that's a trait of Lincoln. You know, you can make all sorts of arguments about Lincoln's character and whether he was always honorable or whatever, but I think he was always empathetic. He was always had this deep, you know, reservoir of human sympathy and understanding. And that's what Cage notices from the very beginning. You know, he had many great qualities, but he had to keep moving ahead. Lincoln was a young man in a hurry.
You talk about Lincoln's ambition. At one point in the book, you have Lincoln say, he's talking about Mary Todd with Cage. You have Lincoln saying, they say happiness can always slow a man down, and I don't have time for that. He is a man on the move.
Absolutely. And, you know, he would fit right into today's political landscape without missing a beat. You know, he would be part of this rough and tumble that we've got going on. And, I mean, he was a politician. I mean, down to his toenails, you know. He wanted it bad. He wanted to advance himself. He wanted to make something of himself. And yet he was also, you know, very principled. And so, to me, what's so fascinating about Lincoln at this time is how much his principles were often at odds with his ambition.
Yeah.
And, you know, he was, like all of us, I think, at this age, we're still learning. We're still learning how to be decent people. And that was part of the process that I'm writing about in this book.
I love the fact that one of the things that you have Lincoln attracted to about Cage Weatherby is that Cage Weatherby he went to Europe. Cage Weatherby has had a trip to Europe, which Lincoln, of course, never had.
Sure.
And he met Lord Byron, the poet's gondolier in Venice.
Right. Yeah.
Where did that come from?
I stole that from a biography of Longfellow. But I thought that was something that would leave Lincoln slack-jawed. You know, the idea that this guy not only crossed the ocean, but he had met somebody who had met Byron.
Yeah.
And Lincoln, you know, this matters because Lincoln had aspirations as a poet as well.
Aside from Page, who himself really wants to be a poet, the other men in this circle really are rather ambitious and driven in terms of what they want to accomplish politically.
Right.
But they also have romantic souls. They all want to write poetry.
Mm-hmm.
And so they come together and they share poems with one another.
Right.
You have a Lincoln poem quoted in the book. Is it a real poem?
Yeah. It's called My Childhood Home I See Again. And it's a really wonderful poem. And about, I think it was 1846 or so, he visited his childhood home in Indiana, where he'd done a lot of his growing up and where his mother was buried and where his childhood friends had grown up and where some of them had kind of had some problems. And he was overcome with nostalgia. And he wrote this very bleak but beautiful, you know, sort of death-haunted poem about how basically everybody dies and gets sick and, you know, goes astray. And, you know, I was impressed with this poem when I read it. You look at Lincoln and you think, man, if he hadn't gone on to be president or gone on in that direction and he had focused his energies on writing, what he might have accomplished in that field, because he was, I think, pretty remarkable. Just a native ability to express himself.
Well, the Gettysburg Address wasn't a bad example of fine writing, nor was the second inaugural.
No, nor the Cooper Union Address. I mean, he could write, but those are, those are prose with an element of poetry.
Right.
You know, Better Angels of Our Nature and stuff like that. But this is pure poetry, and it holds up. I mean, if you saw this in an anthology of, you know, a high school anthology of poetry, you wouldn't skip a beat thinking, oh, this is a real poet who wrote it.
With your permission, Stephen, I'd like to read it. My childhood home I see again and sadden with the view. And still as memory crowds my brain, there's pleasure in it too. Oh, memory, thou midway world twixt earth and paradise, where things decayed and loved ones lost in dreamy shadows rise, and freed from all that's earthly vile, seem hallowed, pure, and bright, like scenes in some enchanted isle, all bathed in liquid light. As dusky mountains please the eye when twilight chases day, as bugle notes the passing by, in distance die away. As leaving some grand waterfall, we, lingering, list its roar. So memory will hallow all we've known, but know no more. Near 20 years have passed away since here I bid farewell to woods and fields and scenes of play and playmates loved so well. Where many were, but few remain of old familiar things, but seeing them to mind again the lost and absent brings. The friends I left that parting day, how changed as time has sped. Young childhood grown, strong manhood gray, and half of all are dead. I hear the loved survivors tell how naught from death could save, till every sound appears a knell, and every spot a grave. I range the fields with pensive tread, and pace the hollow rooms, and feel, companion of the dead, I'm living in the tombs. Death always seems to haunt him.
Absolutely.
He and Cage talk about that, right. And Cage sees it. The poem you've just described, he talks about suicide at times.
This not is, just talks about it. He, you know, is drawn to it.
Yeah, yeah. What did you conclude about that?
I think, you know, there are all these theories about Lincoln. You know, there's a wonderful book called Lincoln's Melancholy by Joshua Wolf Schenck, which goes into great detail about this cast of mind he had. I think what Lincoln was all about was, I think he was a very sensitive person, and I think he endured tragedy during parts of his life and humiliation, and both of those things could set him into a deep, dark depression. But he seemed to grow out of it. I mean, in other words, there were a couple times in his life when he was non-functional, when his girlfriend in New Salem, we think Anne Rutledge, died. He fell into a deep, deep, dark pit. Later, when he had this very curious falling out with Mary Todd, he became suicidal and darkly depressed. But after that, you know, you think of everything he endured, you know, the loss of 2 children while he was alive, the unbelievable stress and trauma and sadness of the Civil War that he conducted. And he functioned reasonably well. So I think he had the ability to absorb those shocks and move on. And I think it was only in his, you know, formative years when it was life-threatening, that kind of depression.
You talk about how important honor was, really, to all of the characters in your book. But Lincoln at one point says, you happen to say, I can't live if my friends think I have no honor. Mm-hmm. And at the heart, in some ways, of the relationship you create between the fictional Cage Weatherby and the real Abraham Lincoln is absolutely a question of honor. Mm-hmm. And it relates to Lincoln's work as a lawyer. The first time that Lincoln and Weatherby interact in a courtroom is when Weatherby is a witness in a murder,
right,
that Lincoln is defending the accused in,
right,
correct? Talk to us about that.
Well, this is a real case.
Oh, it is?
Yeah. This one, there was a guy named Henry Truett who felt he had been slandered by another guy named Jacob Early, who in fact was Lincoln's captain in the Black Hawk War, in this company he was in. And so he walks into the Globe Tavern, where Early is sitting there reading a newspaper or a book or something, and he accuses, or, you know, Truett accuses Early of slandering him, and pulls out a pistol. And Early stands up from the chair he's sitting in, and raises the chair to defend himself from being shot, but it doesn't work, and Truett shoots him and kills him. So Truett goes on trial for murder, and Lincoln defends him. And in my book, one of the people who's in the Globe Tavern witnesses this is Cage Weatherby. He saw the murder, and he's shaken up by it. And Lincoln cross-examines Cage and maneuvers him into the position that could it have been that when Jacob Early, the guy who was killed, raised this chair, that he was attacking Truett and that Truett shot him in self-defense. And it's a famous case where Lincoln, against all logic and evidence, really got this cold-blooded murder off on a charge of self-defense or on a plea of self-defense. And so I've used that incident to sort of sow the seeds of conflict between Lincoln and Cage.
Weatherby is shocked that Lincoln would essentially create a fictional scenario
right.
to get his client off this murder charge.
Right.
He's shocked by it.
Yeah. And Lincoln is shocked that he's shocked because Lincoln, you know, above all, Lincoln believes that his duty to his clients is sacrosanct. I mean, he is, you know, he'll take a case and he will prosecute that case, you know, to the best he can for his client. And this leads to discussions all the way through the book about righteousness versus order, basically. And it's sort of opens up a rift between those two men.
Lincoln also, in real life, at one point or another, had an involvement with slave owners, right?
Lincoln did represent slave owners and, who were trying to keep their, quote, property. It seems inconsistent with our image of him as the great emancipator, but it's consistent with his work as a lawyer and with his character. You know, it's the whole issue of slavery and abolition and Lincoln is so complex at this time. You know, it's hard to get a clear image of what he believed when and how his thinking about slavery evolved. But you have to remember he was a politician in Illinois in the 1830s and 1840s, and abolition was the third rail. I mean, you did not go near that if you wanted to get reelected. He was not advanced in his thinking, but he was someone who could evolve as a human being.
So as we close, what did you decide about Abraham Lincoln as you wrote this book, as you researched him? What did you decide about him as a person?
I decided that he had a good heart that was often at odds with his desperate need to advance himself. There's the real Lincoln, and there's the Lincoln I lived with every day for 4 years, you know, as a character. I ended up examining his flaws as closely and as with much scrutiny as I could, coming away feeling like, well, I'm a friend of Mr. Lincoln. You know, I know this guy.
And what you've done, I think, in A Friend of Mr. Lincoln is helped us see a very real human being. And that's an accomplishment when we're talking about an iconic figure in the history of the world. So congratulations, Stephen Kerrigan.
Well, thank you, Bill. It's a delight to talk to you.
Thanks. Stephen Kerrigan is the author of A Friend of Mr. Lincoln. It's the story of Abraham Lincoln's early life in Springfield, Illinois. It charts the beginning of his ambitious political aspirations as well as his efforts at love and romance. When we come back, we'll talk with one of Georgia's most beloved writers of Southern culture, Roy Blunt Jr. He has a new book out, Save Room for Pie. And don't we all do that? First a break. Welcome back to Two-Way Street. I'm Bill Nigut. Roy Blunt Jr. really is one of those guests who needs no introduction. But if you happen to be one of the uninitiated, here's what you've been missing. Blunt grew up in Decatur, Georgia, graduated from Decatur High School, and went on to Vanderbilt and Harvard. He honed his talents as a reporter at the Atlanta Journal and other Southern newspapers, and then landed at Sports Illustrated. But over the years since, he's become probably the best-known and funniest interpreter of Southern ways to the rest of the world. His latest book, Save Room for Pie, is a collection of stories, poems, songs, and other odds and ends about food. Roy Blunt Jr., thank you so much for being here for Two-Way Street.
Thank you, Bill.
I want to talk certainly about your new book, Save Room for Pie, but I really want to ask you another question to start. Who is Roy Blunt Sr.?
Roy Blunt Sr. was my father.
Yes.
Obviously. He was a pillar of the community of Decatur, Georgia, and of Atlanta as a whole. He was president of the Atlanta Chamber of Commerce at one point. He was chairman of the Metropolitan Atlanta Rapid Transit Authority. He was a very long-suffering and high-minded and public-spirited guy. And there's a, on the Decatur Town Square, there's a Roy Blunt Memorial Plaza, a little plaque there.
So I asked you that because you have, throughout your career, maintained your title of Roy Blunt Jr. I could only imagine that it might be because of your deference to your dad.
Well, yeah, in a way. I mean, I started out writing a column at the Atlanta Journal, and people were taking their money out of my father's savings and loan because of what I was writing. And so I added the junior to differentiate us. And then I went up to Sports Illustrated, and I just sort of kept it. I'd gotten used to making a little swirl at the end of my signature, which formed a junior. I'm very interested in juniors. Someday I have a huge file of junior information. You know, I think something like 38% of American presidents have been named after their fathers. And the test of a junior is if you answer the phone and they say, can I speak to Roy? And you say, Big Roy or Little Roy? You know, you're always Little Roy.
The new book, Save Room for Pie. You've been writing about food and talking about food, singing about food off and on for a long time. But you finally decided you should put it all together in a book, right?
Yeah. Every now and then somebody says, give me the takeaway on your book, which is a whole new kind of TV thing. I don't know where that comes from. It doesn't mean any takeaway. It's meant to be savored and chewed on and nibbled at from all angles. And I'm happy to present it in that way.
Could I ask you to read something that I think is kind of delightful?
Yeah.
You have a story that it's part of your guidelines for how to eat. I think you have five of them. One of them is after five potato chips, you're just trying to reclaim the glory of the first two, and you know it.
Yeah.
But guideline three, I love the description of you as a young boy going to the service station in Decatur to get a pop.
As a boy in Decatur, Georgia, I would ride my bike to the gas station, in front of which stood a big, rusting, red metal box with a slide-open door at the top. I'd reach down into that well of ice, gradually melting among variously shaped cold bottles randomly heaped. And I'd swish around heavily for a while and come up with a new grape, a grapeette, a sum drop, an orange crush with its pebbly, thick-walled bottle, the color of iodine. A Byerly's chocolate drink. Byerly's put out an orange, too. A knee-high black cherry. An RC Cola. A Dr. Pepper. A frosty root beer. A squirt. A Canada Dry ginger ale. Ice water would run down my arm, and I would have myself a very cold, highly satisfactory drink. I don't think anything has ever struck me as prettier colored than new grape foam back then. I was a child with little experience of the world. But in college English, when I came upon, quote, the blushful hippocrene with beaded bubbles winking at the brim and purple stained mouth, it brought back new grape.
That sounds like an absolutely wonderful memory, that the sort of memory that stays with you.
Yeah, right. Well, yeah, I don't know how classy it is, but it's fond.
Guideline number five, save room for pie.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah.
Why save room for pie?
Well, pie being the highest form of food. When we say sweet as an angel eating pie, we do not mean icky, we mean sublime. Eudora Welty in her story, Kin, celebrates the perfect ending to a pleasant day. Quote, wonderful black, bitter, moist chocolate pie under mountains of meringue. Ralph Waldo Emerson, according to his friend James B. Thayer, loved pie so much he ate it regularly for breakfast. One morning, Emerson offered several gentlemen guests, one after another, a piece of pie. Each gentleman declined, but Mr. Emerson remonstrated, thrusting the knife under a piece of the pie and putting the entire weight of his character into his manner. But what is pie for?
Those are just great stories. That's Roy Blunt Jr. reading from his new book, Save Room for Pie. You will not eat foam.
No.
No, none of this molecular gastronomy.
Exactly. What's the point of that? I mean, reducing food down to its elements is what I'm supposed to do in my digestion, not the chef. Bacon foam and mushroom foam. I mean, who wants that? So I much prefer things that like gizzards, which about which you can say the harder something is to eat, the longer you get to taste it. I grew up eating Varsity hot dogs, and they have a kind of chili there. The Varsity chili is different from any other chili I've ever had, and it fits just beautifully on a hot dog. The buns, I knew a man who drove a bread truck and delivered buns to the Varsity years ago, and he said that they would not accept any bun that you couldn't wrap around your finger without it cracking. And so the buns are nice and soft, and they give you a big old handful of onions to put on your chili dog, and they put just a little stripe of mustard on there. You know, lots of chili dogs are just sort of sloppy all over, but one thing Varsity chili is very finely ground, doesn't have beans in it or anything, and so it all holds together. It doesn't slop off into your hands.
You tell a story in the book about coming to do Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me at the Fox Theater, and of course you were right around the corner from the Varsity.
Yeah, I'm nostalgic about Varsity hot dogs and also about the Fox Theater. I used to go to the Fox Theater when I was a kid. One time when I was a little kid, supposedly it's a family story, I dropped my chewing gum on the floor while I was watching a movie in the Fox Theater, and I reached down and picked it up and started chewing it again, and my mother was horrified, but then she said, oh, well, I guess it's okay. It is the Fox.
It is the Fox. Gruesome. You have a number of songs in the book. My personal favorite happens to be Song to Oysters.
Ah, yeah.
But is it an actual song, or is it just the lyric to a song?
There's no tune to it.
Okay.
Every now and then people offer to write music to my some of my food songs, and I'll let them do it, and they tend to be kind of high-flown choral versions of them. But I can recite for you my song to oysters. I don't think really it needs music. I like to eat an uncooked oyster. Nothing's slicker, nothing's moister. Nothing's easier on your gorge or when the time comes to discharge. But not to let it too long rest within your mouth is always best. For if your mind dwells on an oyster, nothing's slicker, nothing's moister. I prefer my oyster fried. Then I'm sure my oysters die.
Thank you very much for sharing that.
You're welcome.
Some months ago, Dave Barry was in here.
Ah.
And I'd like to just play you a piece of what he and I talked about, and then you and I should talk about it as well. So let's listen. Who are the Rock Bottom Remainders?
The Rock Bottom Remainders are, as a band of authors, of which I am a founding member, Stephen King, Amy Tan, Ridley Pearson, Scott Thoreau, Mitch Albom, Roy Blunt Jr., Greg Iles. They're good authors. We're a bad band.
I read somewhere, I think it was your quote, that you're not very talented, but you're loud.
You're loud. Or as Roy Blunt Jr. described our genre, hard-listening music.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You've been doing this for a long time.
Over 20 years, and not through public demand. We do it because we like it. As Amy Tan once said, I would do this to kill the whales.
I have to admit, knowing that Amy Tan is part of this, I can see you. I can see Stephen King. There's just something about Amy Tan.
I know. Everybody thinks she's this thoughtful little, you know.
What is she doing?
Serious woman. She's crazy. She's a wild woman. She dresses up in like tight leather outfits and whips us and sings, "These boots are made for walking." Amy's crazy.
Could we listen to a little of them?
I urge our listeners to hold their ears for the following.
That's enough. Yeah, that's good.
That's enough. How long have you been in that band?
Since the beginning. I'm the least musical member of a
number. What do you play?
I don't play anything. I play the fool. I get up and introduce the band, and then I mill around doing some kind of eccentric dancing every now and then. But also I do things like You Move Me. That's my solo there. You move me. Don't always come.
Wild Thing? Are we talking thing. About?
We're talking about Wild Thing. Yes, we are.
Could you? How do you, how do you deliver that line?
You move me.
You move.
But unfortunately, I don't always deliver it quite at the right moment. I get a little impatient.
It sounds like a great fun experience. For
it is fun for the band. I don't know about anybody else.
So, in finishing up, I wanted to try a few pies with you.
Have you got some?
I do.
Well, sure.
I do. So, the Silver Skillet is one of the great Southern diners.
All right.
So, I brought you three pies, Roy. There's a coconut cream.
That looks good.
You like the way that looks? Here's a chocolate cream, because I think I read in the book you like chocolate cream.
Yeah, Eudora Welty wrote about chocolate cream pie.
But then I brought, so the Silver Skillet's famous for their lemon icebox pie.
All right.
So I brought you some pie, and I brought you some, I brought you a fork.
Well, if I'd known this was coming, I would have saved more room for pie. But, but I will certainly.
So you're going for the coconut cream.
I'm not going to pass it up a nice cup, piece of pie.
Right.
Mm. Great thing, of course, about coconut pie is that it's all gooey, but it has those, it has that fiber in it.
A chewy coconut on top. I don't think it can get much better than that.
And then somebody said recently to me, you're either a cake person or a pie person in the same way that you're either a robot person or a monkey person. The pie person goes with the monkey person. Yeah. But I think that's kind of unfair both to the pie and the cake. But pie just has more going on than a cake.
It's good.
I'm going to leave some of this for you. But
Believe me, there are people here on our team that would love that. I think you're going now for the lemon.
Going for the lemon now.
Pie. So as we close.
That's good because it's got that tang, of course, the lemon tang that cuts into the sweetness. But the sweetness is there.
There's there. So when you started writing about the South, and in some ways explaining the South in your own humorous style to people from other parts of the country, does the country still see the South in the way that it did when Jimmy Carter was in the White House? Has the country come to see the South differently, or is the South so much different than
I think the South has spread. I mean, you can get good Southern food in Brooklyn now. You can get, I remember when you couldn't get, they didn't really understand fried chicken in the North, but you can get good Southern food, and it's even kind of fashionable now in New York. So there's that. And but still, people tell, you know the term microaggression? I get a lot of microaggressions as a Southerner. In the North, people don't even realize there's anything. You know, they get this kind of expression on their face and talk about the South as this bizarre kind of place. And Southern food, even, they'll say, you know, look at me like, I know you don't really like it, but just tell us, you know, do your thing, do your little act about Southern food. In fact, I love Southern food, and I don't know why everybody else doesn't. If they don't, I don't care. Let them morph Southern food for me if they think it's silly. But, I mean, there's still people still feel entitled to be at least microaggressive about the South. And, you know, one reason is that Southerners don't tend to call them on it that much. Southerners tend to roll with it, and if they get really offensive, then Southerners will hit them.
Roy Blunt, Jr., your new book, Save Room for Pies, it's just a delight to read, and I've really enjoyed having you here today. Thank you for coming in.
Thank you, Bill.
Roy Blunt, Jr.'s new book is Save Room for Pie. It's a collection of stories, poems, songs, and other odds and ends about food. By the way, next Tuesday night, April 12th, we're going to tape Two-Way Street in front of a live audience at the Jimmy Carter Presidential Library. Our guest will be historian Randall Woods, who's written a new book on how LBJ passed his Great Society legislation. We'd love to have you join us. You can get all the information you need by going to gpb.org/TWS. Remember, if you can't be near a radio when we're on the air, you can download the Two-Way Street podcast from iTunes or your favorite podcast provider. All of our shows are archived at the website, and you can listen to them there whenever you'd like. Our producer is Jenny Ament. I'm Bill Nygut. Thanks for being with us today. I hope you'll join us again next week for another Two-Way Street.
Just like old saxophone Joe, when he's got the hogs head up on his toes. Oh, me, oh, my, love that country pie. Listen to the fiddler play, when he's playing till the break of day. Oh, me, oh, my, love that country pie. That's best strawberry, lemon, and lime. What do I care? Blueberry, apple, cherry, pumpkin, and plum. Call me for dinner, honey, I'll be there. Saddle me up my big white goose. Tie me on and turn her loose. Oh, me, oh, my. Love that country pie.